Well, it's the bleary-eyed Me and Mario show the morning after the election. In other words, we want to tell you folks where we are. We are here on a Wednesday morning recording this program. So you now have to put that in the right historical context, because by the time you hear the show, things may have changed. Right, Governor?
You say it's morning?
Yeah.
Good.
This is so interesting. The clock has gone around. Did you sleep at all on Tuesday night?
I fell asleep at 3 o'clock, just on the sofa watching the television, because I had had a rough few days. And at 3:30, I got a call. I won't tell you from what network, radio station.
Right.
And it's a radio station I listen to with some regularity.
Right.
And they woke me up at 3:30. And I said, from now on, I'm listening to WABC instead of you guys. But so we got a half hour there. And then I did Jack Kemp on the television this morning. We had a debate.
Uh-huh.
But I'm up to date on most of the facts, I think.
Yeah, okay. So let's talk a little bit about how all of this works out. First of all, it comes down astoundingly to Florida. Tell me about your thoughts.
With apologies for drifting a bit,
sure.
I think... I made notes during the night because I have a feeling that this historic event, and it is, of course, historic, offers up us an opportunity to consider where we are as a nation politically in the most profound ways, because I think it raises a lot of profound questions that go way beyond the mechanics of the election and whether or not you should have an electoral college and how you count votes and whether the media should speak prematurely as it did last night and apparently chased some votes away from the polls by announcing that Gore had won while people were still standing online waiting to vote. Apart from all those things, all of which are significant, and we should talk about them, there are profound questions. Like three commentators on three different networks said at one point or another in the long night that this evenness suggests that Nader is right and that there isn't really much to choose between the two parties. And it seemed to me that was about as inaccurate an analysis as you could make, and that even a glance at the breakdowns on who was voting for whom and where shows you that we are dramatically, if not polarized, dramatically separated from one another in the major parties. White men from the South and rural areas who are rich, all or most of them, voted for the Republicans. Poor workers who are not high-skilled workers, women, ethnics, especially African Americans, voted for the Democrat. Women for the Democrat by a large margin, men for the Republicans by a large margin. It's difficult to imagine more fragmentation. Now, maybe it has always been this way. The Republicans accuse the Democrats of class warfare. I can't make an argument for the poor and the middle class without my opponent in a debate saying, there he goes again, class warfare. On the other hand, the basic Republican dogma, as pronounced by consistently with all the conservatives of the past by George W. Bush, is if we take care of the rich by greasing the skids for them, they will move faster and further and carry us along a way and eventually, use the term trickle down if you want, but the sequelae from this, the magic of supply side, will enrich the rest of the population. That's not happening the way it should. And what I think, and I'm going to finish with this, the most important question that comes out of this race is, what argument do you make as a political leader, whether you're George Bush as president or Al Gore? What argument do you make that brings both sides together and that says, look, you don't have to weaken the strong in order to strengthen the weak? It doesn't have to be, I want to take care of the rich investors and entrepreneurs and Mario and his clients instead of the other people and put them at sufferance of the leakage from the success of the rich. It doesn't have to be that way. It could be this way, that I want to enhance the productivity of every part of this nation, particularly people who are undereducated, undercared for, and therefore underproductive. Remember, 75% of our workforce is low and moderate skilled and not high skilled. And so many of our poor have virtually no skill for this market. And, you know, there's no reason why we can't make an argument that, look, by strengthening them through education and health care, making them more productive, we then enrich further the top of the ladder because they have the biggest part of the economy. Enhanced productivity, of course, will help your economy. And when the economy gets better, you will still do better than everybody else because you've got a bigger piece. You have more shares. You have more invested. You own the business. And that's wonderful. No objection. Because now, indeed, the tide is going to lift all boats. It's not doing that now. And I think that's what ought to come out of this race. But I'm not sure. There's a lot of agreement on that. But I think what this demonstrates is great polarization. I'll use that word. Separation of the people who are Democrats and the people who are Republican. And I don't think that is the best possible situation. What do you think?
Well, first of all, I think that you're listening to me and Mario. I say that in all due respect. Now, let me move on. I have to say that I want to know about what we face, the mechanics. You gave a, I thought, rather brilliant philosophical description of what's wrong or the way what this country faces. But what happens now?
I don't think it's extremely complicated. And I think these are the predicates. Now, this is the practical situation, the legal situation. First of all, open your mind to the reality that there is a lot that is not legally ordained here, that is legally open.
Right.
For example, if I am an elector in the state of New York pledged to George Bush, I was not elected an elector because Bush lost in the state of New York. But I'm a Gore elector, but I don't like Al Gore. Even though he got the popular vote, can I vote against him? Do you know the answer to that,
yes,
Alan?
I do.
And what is the answer?
In some states, well, first of all, the answer is yes, you can vote
okay.
against him. But and in some states, they try to make it difficult for you to do that by passing a law. And they say you can be fined, you can go to jail.
Exactly. Yeah. But then what is to stop people who voted for Bush in a state that voted for Bush, and you are then a Bush elector, and on December 18th, you gather with the other electors around the country to go through the Electoral College operation. And you say, as a matter of conscience, and maybe you were reached by some Gore people, and maybe they importuned you, maybe they importuned a whole bunch of you. And you said, look, the other guy won the popular vote, and we don't care what the founding fathers had in mind. It was an entirely different time. It was a time when women couldn't vote, the blacks couldn't vote, they were enslaved. I mean, it was an entirely different time. We're going to do the right thing as a matter of conscience and vote for Gore.
Right.
Now, will it happen? No, I don't think so.
I agree with that.
Now, and what that means, so that's an example of the things that aren't determined yet legally. And that's why the concession statement by Gore, had it been made, would have been wonderfully generous and self-sacrificial because, as a practical matter, it would have mooted all those possibilities in the Electoral College, notwithstanding he was the popular vote winner. Mm-hmm. Now, legally, I don't think the concession statement would effectively have stopped electors from being faithless electors. I don't think it would have. But as a practical matter, it would have. And as a practical matter, the people do accept the concession statement, and they don't proceed to try to manipulate their way to a better kind of justice. So what's going to happen? You're going to have a recount. This is Wednesday morning that we're talking.
Right.
I'm told by friends in Florida and by the Attorney General's office that it will be completed probably sometime today.
Is the Attorney General in Florida Democrat or Republican?
He is a Democrat, but he has nothing to do with the recount.
Who does
except
that?
To supervise it. Election groups at local levels.
Now, are these groups beholden to the Governor Jeb Bush?
Not to my knowledge. And that's a nice thing about what's happened so far. I don't believe anybody's really suggesting that Jeb Bush would manipulate. I'm sure he'd do anything illegal. I'm sure he'd love to see his brother win. We take that for granted. And I don't think Bob Butterworth, who is the Attorney General and also happens to be the Gore chair, I don't think he would do whatever he could do as Attorney General to, in any way, improperly affect this race.
Well, so okay, but here at Public Radio, I've been getting these calls all morning long about people who have been reading about voting irregularities in Palm Beach County, in which thousands, apparently, this is what I'm being told, I have no firsthand knowledge, obviously, thousands of people voted. Now, I hope this isn't an urban myth, for Buchanan, thinking that they were voting for Gore.
There is no question that a lot did. I don't know if it's a thousand or thousands. And there's no question that there'll be all sorts of problems like that in Florida. Another possibility, that will give birth, prompt, stimulate similar inquiries in other places. That's already begun. And no surprise there, in 1960, when John Kennedy and Richard Nixon were in their very close battle, the Republicans, I believe Kennedy was ahead by a hair in the popular vote, but the Republicans all over the United States and in 11 specific places demanded recounts. Now, that kind of thing is going to at least be thought about right now. I can't imagine all the states sitting back with a situation where Gore is the popular winner, but it looks like he might not win because of a recount in Florida. He might lose the Electoral College. That has to stimulate millions of Americans to say, isn't there something we can do about that? So I would suspect that there'll be all sorts of legal questions arising. Maybe we should demand a recount in our state, whatever it is. Missouri. We should have won Missouri. Conahan won Missouri. Why didn't Gore win Missouri? Et cetera, et cetera. So a lot of things can happen there.
Okay, we have so much to talk about. Let me ask you about the popular vote versus the Electoral College. It seems my analysis is you dance with the girl who brought you or the guy who brought you. So therefore, do I think that all those red states in the middle of the map are going to support a constitutional amendment which would basically nullify what happened to their guy, the Republican who won? That way, I suspect we're not going to see that happen. Do you agree?
Absolutely. I think we could argue for a long time about the wisdom of the Electoral College. And if you're a Gore person, as I am this cycle, and very much for Al Gore, and very convinced that he would make the better president of the United States by far, not even close, in my opinion, if you're a Gore person, you're tempted to say something should be done about this Electoral College. He was the popular winner, and he should have won the Electoral College. And I am tempted to say that. And if they hired me, I'd probably make the argument in court for them. But the truth is, there's good reason to keep the Electoral College. It's bad enough to get a full and fair distribution of attention in the campaign year for the little people, the little states. And if you got rid of it and made it all popular vote, I suspect the obvious thing for you to do as a consultant or as a candidate would be to go to the places where there are the most votes. And that means the cities, and that means the big states. And so much for the Adirondacks, and so much for the rural part of America, so much for the people down south or in Wyoming, etc. And now that's the theoretical and perhaps even philosophical approach. Yours, the practical approach, ends the discussion as far as I'm concerned, that whatever nice argument you have, it is not realistic. You need 2/3 of the Congress in each house and then 3/4 of the states. I don't think you can come even close. So there will be talk in the Congress. There'll be many articles written. There'll be many letters to the editor, and then it will go away.
Can I just make one philosophical point? You're listening to me and Mario. Now, let's talk a little bit about the Senate. The Senate, as I understand it now, maybe your numbers are better than mine, as it stands now with one in doubt, is now 51-49.
Now, tell me what's in doubt.
Washington State Slade Gordon.
I thought he lost Gordon.
I don't know. All I know is...
Well, what your 51-49 says what about Gordon?
I think says that that's too close, that he assumes he wins, I believe.
Oh, he assumes he wins.
Yeah.
Then it's 50-50.
Could be. Now...
I think it's 50-50.
Let's say it's 50-50. Now, let's say you get a recount, and I predicted this, by the way. I absolutely predicted this. And I think the record will show that you and I probably even talked about it. Because I didn't like the fact that Joe Lieberman, who could have handed that state to Mr. Blumenthal, the popular attorney general, and then there'd be no question right now. But let's assume that the recount happens in Florida, and you end up with a Gore win, and Lieberman has to resign and hands it from the Senate seat and hands it to the Republican governor.
this would be unbelievable.
Yeah, which, however you look at it, it's going. If it's 50-50, however you look at it, the Democrats cannot get control. Because if they win, they lose Lieberman. If they lose, the
vice president
has control.
But by the way, is the vice president allowed to help them organize in a 50-50 situation? Do you know that?
When you say help them organize.
In other words, elect a majority leader.
You mean lobby them?
No. In other words, Trent Lott is now the majority leader.
Right.
Let's just say it's 50-50.
He does not vote for the leader.
Oh, well, then how can they have a leader if it's 50-50?
Oh, if there's a tie vote in any Senate business, he will vote. Yes.
Oh, even the majority leader?
Yes.
Okay. Now, that answers that question, and thank you for that.
So we agree that whatever happens here, there will be control, literally, technically, by the Republicans, which is the nightmare scenario that I suggested.
You did. If
Bush
many
wins,
times.
I said, no way you get rid of Lott and Hastert. And that's what's happened. Came close, but that's what's happened. And so for the first time in American history, you will have an modern history, because conservatives and liberals didn't mean anything, I don't think, in the first century. You'd have an all-conservative government.
And
you had an all-Republican government in 1952 with Eisenhower,
right.
But it wasn't anything like this. And you didn't have Roe against Wade, and you didn't have affirmative action, and you didn't have the issues or the sharp conservatism then that you have now. After all, Eisenhower, talk about big government, he gave us the interstate highway program.
It's clear that you'll have a very busy Republican vice president sitting in the Senate a lot, right?
Could be, yes, yeah. Could be.
Okay. Secondly, let's talk a little bit about Ralph Nader, if we could. And I want to talk about media, and we only got 6 minutes left. What do you make of the Nader phenomenon now? Apparently, he didn't do that well, a couple of percent.
I think, once again, this is one of the questions that you could argue theoretically, philosophically, idealistically, and have a lot of fun.
I like
Ralph Nader and always did. And he's served a lot of, he's done a lot for this country. He's a loser. I predicted this, too, and we agreed.
Mm-hmm.
He's a loser. Every way you can be a loser, I think. I mean, his supporters won't regard him as a loser, and he'll always have a voice with them, and he'll always have a role. However, he doesn't get the 5%. That means he cannot argue this is a substantial movement toward a third party,
mm-hmm.
because he predicated that on 5%, which would get him money. So he doesn't get that. Then what did he achieve except to defeat Al Gore and assure George Bush? Very little. And so it seems to me most Democrats are going to be unhappy with him, very unhappy with him. And there isn't much reason for the others to be happy with him except in some spiritual way. Because as a practical matter, the argument will be you didn't achieve anything. Well, we taught you a lesson. What's the lesson?
Yeah, right.
That if we are not perfectly in tune with your specific route to the same goal that we both have, if we happen to take a more remote avenue there because we're trying to get around certain obstacles that you don't see as clearly as we do, then you're going to destroy us because we're not going as fast as you'd like us to go or taking the same route. We don't think that that's very... I happen to be one of the people who think that it was a mistake. I don't want to discourage any progressives. I'm not far from most of the Nader positions. I'm probably regarded as more liberal than most Democrats. But with all of that, we should have Al Gore as president and not George Bush. And you made it impossible in Florida. You hurt us in Florida and in other places. And I'm sorry about that.
Talk to me a little bit about your old friend and, your communication chief, Tim Russert, who many people don't know was your communication chief, and before that, chief of staff for Pat Moynihan. And a lot of people think, and I'm one of them, I hate to say this because you always get mad at me when I impute motive and stuff, has been bending over backwards for years to be overfair to the Republicans to prove that he's really not a Democrat anymore. I want to talk about that because the first thing I saw when I turned on the television this morning was Russert defending NBC, calling Florida, taking it back, I saw Russert's behavior in the Hillary Clinton thing. I think Hillary Clinton, the first debate, I think Hillary Clinton owes a great deal, frankly, to Tim Russert for being impossible in that debate and ambushing her the way he did. Tell me about your impressions of the media.
Well, let me talk to you about Tim Russert.
Please.
I hear your criticism. I've heard other criticism from Democrats about Tim Russert. I've heard at least as much criticism about him from Republicans. That's good enough for me. Cheney refused to go on the program. Why? Because they thought that he leans too far toward them? Well, obviously not. So I think what you perceive is a Tim Russert who's hard on the politicians because he sees that as the role of the press.
As much
as
I'd like
to
agree with you,
that the politician addresses the questions that the politician would prefer not to address for his or her own welfare. And his mission is to get the truth from them, even if it's as tough as a dentist pulling your tooth out without Novocaine. But I think he's equal in his relentlessness. I don't think he was uneven about it.
Well, that, of course, puts us in different camps on this, doesn't it? Because I do, and I think that the media, particularly some in the media like CNN, have been consistently leaning towards the Republican side. And frankly, and this is going to shock a lot of people who are listening to this program, I think the same thing is true of NPR. I think I'm worried, really worried, that they have become so politicized, so used to the federal money, that they bend over backwards to make sure that they are not going to alienate these Republicans in the United States Congress. I've seen it
time and again. We have some personal experience with that on a kind of small scale, I think, Alan.
Yes, we do.
And that's something we're looking at the moment.
Yeah. So let me ask you this. Is there, when you come out of this election, the idea in your mind in a minute and 21 seconds that campaign financing has either won or lost based on this election?
Campaign financing is triumphant if Bush wins.
I'm talking about public campaign financing.
Public campaign financing is, the issue of campaign financing is destroyed by Bush's victory. The argument for campaign financing is triumphant. Why? Because look at John McCain. Look at the difference between McCain and both of these people. Neither Al Gore, my candidate, nor George Bush, other people's candidate, stirred the kind of enthusiasm that John McCain did. And he did it with what argument? Basically with campaign finance and some other things too. And so the country loves the idea of campaign finance. The Democrats voted for campaign finance. Al Gore swore that he would make it its first bill.
Governor.
The Republicans are going to kill it, and they are now in charge in every House, both houses, and the presidency. Campaign financing for now, reform, is dead.
10 seconds. 10 seconds only on Hillary.
Terrific. Huge win. Much bigger than anybody expected. Makes New York and California, but I put New York first, the Democratic state in the United States of America, with a huge victory for Gore, a huge victory for Hillary, come from behind, abused, taken advantage of, tough, disciplined. It was Hillary against Hillary, and Hillary won.
And that's it. And a one and a two. And everybody together now. That's all the time we have for this week. Thanks for joining us. I don't hear you. Please send us your thoughts about the program. You can email us at meandmario, that's one word, at WAMC.org, or write us at meandmario, 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. Make sure you tell us where you're writing from. Cassette copies of Me and Mario are available by calling 1-800-323-9262. That number again is 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 0045, where we talk about Tim Russert. Thanks to our producer, David Gustina, our engineer, Pat Cooney. I'm Alan Chartok. He is, of course, the very tired but very busy Mario Cuomo. We'll see you all again next week. Governor, thank you for doing this.
Did I talk too low at the end there when I tried to join in?